Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're going to talk about a book, another book by a Chapel Hill author. It's called Flood Markers, and the author is Nick Brown. Nick lives in Chapel Hill, and many people, Nick, know you from the music world.
That's my former life and still part of my life today, but yeah, I worked as a musician for a number of years. When I was in high school, actually, well, I formed a band to play my eighth grade dance.
Oh, come on, where?
In Greensboro, where I grew up. And we stayed together through high school, and by the time I graduated high school, we got a record deal.
Oh, come on.
A big record deal.
What was the name of the group?
The name of the band was Athenaeum, and I was the youngest member. The other guys were a year or two out of high school. So when I graduated, we signed a record deal with Atlantic Records, which, when you're 18, there's nothing cooler than that. So I'd enrolled in college at the time and said, sorry, guys, I'm going to play drums. So we had this record deal and recorded our first album, and that album ended up coming out in 98, and we had a big radio hit, actually, off of it. We had a top 10 modern rock radio hit, for real.
Come on.
Yeah. I mean, you know, at any given point, there are a million different charts and a million different hits on the radio.
Yeah, but you've got, I mean, of course, it's not just one set of charts. There are a whole bunch of different charts. But within that genre,
yeah,
you guys were in the top 10.
We did.
And
we
does
did
that really does well. That translate into selling 10 records or 1,000 or 1,000,000 or what?
We sold about 100,000 records of that first album, which, I mean, it's pretty good, and kept us doing it for a few years. And after you know, we toured forever for that record, and then recorded a second one for Atlantic. And then by then, I wanted to go to college, and so I went. I'd enrolled when I was in high school and told them, hey, I'm going to defer. And they let me defer. And then, you know, who knows where that letter went, when in whatever van or state where I was. And so 5 years later, I called them back. You know, this was Columbia where I'd enrolled. And I said, you know, I'd like to reapply. And they said, well, your SAT scores expire after 4 years. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't take the SAT, you know.
You've been out exactly. of high school academics.
There's nothing I could imagine. Yeah. So they said, well, let us check your records. And so they checked my files and they said, actually, Nick, you're still enrolled. So
you're still enrolled.
It's the best news I'd ever gotten. So I moved up to New York and went to college to really pursue writing. I mean, at that point in my mind, that's when I was starting to make the shift from playing music.
Well,
to
did
writing.
You have? I'm always interested more in the economics than the creativity aspects of it. And you've sold. You're with a group. You sold 100,000 copies of a record.
Yeah.
You have to then understand the record company gets most of that. Writer, you know, a whole bunch of splits, and then at some point, a member of the group gets his or her share. And is there anything left to divide?
Not much. I mean, no is the basic answer. You get these mystery checks that show up in the mail every now and then for, you know, $100-$200 for something. Some sort of royalties. But, you know, I mean, the money we made playing music, we split up to live.
Split up and spent.
It wasn't a lot. We ran ran our little business with it and paid our
Does a band that is able to sell its records with a major record company and to making a list in one genre or another, is that where the fun is? That the basic source of income, or is the basic source of income what you can get from concerts and playing in dives and stuff like that? Where does
from? First of all, the whole music world is completely different right now. I mean, in the past 12 years, there's been a major shift. And at the time, in the 90s, we had a big advance from the record label. And that's really what we ran the business off of and paid our rent and sort of lived off of, in addition to making some money on the road. These days, you know, like I said, music is not a huge part of my life anymore professionally. But there aren't big record label advances like that anymore for groups like the group that I was in. You know, I mean, I'm sure that the 50 Cent's and the, you know,
sure. Yeah,
those stars are getting big advances. But at the time, we had an advance, and we lived in real dumpy little apartments with unbelievably cheap rent, and so we made it last for years.
Well, we came together, and we yes. came together not to praise your music, but
right.
and nor to bury your writing, but to talk about the writing.
Yes.
And the thing that's exciting to me is you're a first-time novelist, and you're apparently what you did when you went to Columbia to learn to write worked out pretty well.
I guess so. I mean, the difference between music and writing is when you play music, you're usually playing with somebody else or you're playing in front of an audience, and you have an idea immediately if what you're doing works in a real visceral way, you know. With writing, it is really alienating, and in that you feel like you're in a vacuum, you know. And what I mean is there were years where I could read a piece of writing or somebody else's, you know, a published book or a friend's manuscript and know immediately what I thought of it, you know. But yet I could write my own work and have no idea if it worked at all, if it was good or bad, or, you know, no perspective on it. And, I mean, in a sense, you know, I mean, I still have that feeling about some of my work, although my confidence is, you know, growing just as I spend more time with the craft. But it just, there was no energy to feed off of another artist in the room, you know, whereas with music, if I wrote I'm a drummer, that's my instrument. If I wrote a drum part to accompany a song, if it didn't work, we knew immediately if it didn't work. If I'm in a room and I write some terrible sounding line of dialogue and it doesn't work, there's nobody in there to tell me it doesn't work except for me. And there's also nobody in there with me giving me ideas to bounce off of. So that took some getting used to in my sort of creative process.
That's real interesting from the standpoint of the artistry of each of those different ways to work the creative process. You do think of, in the old days, help me with this because I don't know. I'm getting ready to ask a question that you might have to really shoot me down.
All right.
But you have the impression that Beethoven, Chopin,
yeah,
that these guys did work by themselves to get the basic music out there. I'm sure that
sure.
there were adaptations when they heard it played, but
yeah.
that there was something like the novelist spirit of I've got it all together and I get it down on paper. But what you say, not today. That's not the way it works. We work together we in the music business
yeah.
work together with our colleagues to flesh it out.
Well, that's definitely the way that, you know, the groups that I worked with wrote songs and had the songs, you know, presented. You know, I mean, we would write a song, and if it was done, we'd play it that night if we were on tour, you know, so we'd be able to bounce ideas off each other and then show up in a club and see if people fell asleep or not, you know. So, you know, I mean, the reason that I brought that up is I knew that I'd had success musically, but when I did go to college and was writing, I didn't know really if it was working or not. You know, I had my small workshops in college and would get some feedback, and so it was a validation for me and a real thrill when, you know, I was touring with other groups at the time and sent off part of this manuscript that's now my book, sent off the manuscript as part of an application for grad school to the wow. Iowa Writers Workshop.
Well, I want to talk some about your education as a writer,
sure.
but we came together to talk about your book.
Yeah.
And it's called Flood Markers. And the thing I think that grabbed me first about your book is the time setting.
Yeah.
Although it seems like recent history when we remember Hurricane Hugo and Hurricane Fran
yeah.
that hit sort of different parts of the Piedmont, but nevertheless, they're memorable moments for those of us who went through them. And so you've got a set of stories set at that time. Then you start looking back and say, golly, that was
20 years ago.
It's
20 years ago in September.
So tell us
yeah.
about Flood Markers, what it is,
yeah.
And how it came together.
Well, Flood Markers is a a collection of 12 Lynx stories that happen in the same town on the day that Hurricane Hugo blows into North Carolina. And as you mentioned, that was 20 years ago. It was September 22nd, 1989. So close to 20 years ago, soon to be 20 years. And it was, you know, at the time, I was 12 years old in 1989.
And you were in Greensboro?
I was in Greensboro. And, you know, I vividly remember Hurricane Hugo coming through town, mostly for the fact that in Greensboro, you know, we thought that it was just going to devastate us. All the forecasts had Hugo blowing straight into Greensboro, so I got the day off school, and, you know, that's probably really why I remember it. But Hugo ended up blowing a little further westward and really devastated Charleston and Charlotte, and Greensboro just got glanced by the storm. And in Flood Markers, I create a fictional town, Lystra, that is...
You say Lystra.
I say Lystra. There's a lot of discussion about the name of this town. There's the road, Old Lystra, which I've also heard called Old Lystra. And that's where I got the idea for the name of this town. I just like the sound of the word. I always say it Lystra.
All right, well, it's your book.
Yeah, exactly. And I figure, you know.
So there's a mythical town that's set somewhere in the alongside the path of
that's right.
Hugo, not Greensboro, because your town's too small to be Greensboro. And how'd you develop the imagination? Give us more about where this town might be and what it's like.
Lystra, in my mind, I used what I wanted from my memories of Greensboro, and I used what I wanted from my knowledge of Chapel Hill, where I live now and have lived for years, and put that together in one town and made it a little bit smaller. And those three things are, I mean, that's the beauty of being a fiction writer, is I don't have to deal with parts of a town that I don't understand. I can use the details of different towns that I know and then make it small enough that I feel like I understand the whole town. So in my mind, Lystra is in the North Carolina Piedmont. It's sort of like, yeah, around Burlington, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. But maybe the size
Mebane, Burlington.
That area.
Siler City,
yes.
Something like that.
And maybe even a little bit smaller than those towns. But it was fun for me to create my own world.
You got 12 stories in there, and we're going to talk about those stories after this short break. We're visiting with Nick Brown about his first published work of fiction, Flood Markers. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Chapel Hill's Nick Brown. Nick, we're going to talk some more about Flood Markers, but tell us what you're doing right now, in addition to writing and raising a family.
Well, yeah, I do have a 10-month daughter, Frances, and I just submitted my second book to the publisher, which is a novel called Doubles. It's about doubles tennis players. And so I submitted that, and that process will take a while, I'm sure, editing and getting that out into the world. In the meantime, I work at the Ackland Art Museum here at Chapel Hill, which is...
So you're not content to do music writing. You got to go into another genre of art and tell us about... well, we can all say painting. How do we define
The visual art?
The visual,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, my role there, I'm not an art historian or a visual artist, but my role at the Ackland is I handle communications.
You get the word out.
Yes, I get the word out, which means that I get to write about visual art. And I'm sure there's a guy like me at the dental school, too. And I got nothing against teeth, but, you know, he probably has to learn about dentures and root canals and write press releases and stuff about this. So I really feel blessed that I get to spend my days in an art museum. You know, I have to go down into the basement and talk to the curators about Rubens and stuff, and it's pretty fascinating. So in the scheme of jobs,
a great job for somebody who was a student, yeah, who likes to learn about things. And
for
so
sure,
we can look for your third book of fiction to be about the art world.
Oh, watch out.
Well, I do want to talk some more about Flood Markers, and it's you've told us about the fictional town in which your stories are set. What is, I guess the question that I was going to ask you, and so I'll ask it, and then you can be as mean as you want to in the response, but
yeah,
is this a novel or a book of short stories?
Well, it's a novel about a town.
It's fair to call it a novel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I say it's a novel about a town. It's a novel about Lystra. It's a collection of short stories about individuals. Now,
so it's a novel about a town, a string set of short stories about different individuals.
Yeah.
And it's but they're common characters who slip in and out of those
That's
stories.
Right.
And how do I say this? It's not unique as a form, but this is an unusual.
It is.
And tell us about how you dealt with that as you put it together, as you strung it together,
yeah.
and then as you sold it, and as your agent and editors dealt with this as a form of literary art.
Yeah. Well, I conceived of the book as short stories that all happen on the same day in the same town. Now, as the structure started to come together, the characters started popping up in other stories, and the structure, thanks to Hugo, really created its own narrative arc. The storm blows into town, the storm blows out of town, crisis occurs, crisis, you know, abates, the day starts, the day ends. And so I was lucky in creating this sort of insular world and this very enclosed time structure. But as I was writing it, the bits and pieces, the chapters were conceived as short stories. And, you know, in a way, I do think of this as more of a short story collection. But on the other hand, it's not useful for me, especially in the creative process, to really stamp it as one form or another. You know, if the creative act is working for me, then I sort of went with it. Now, this sent the agents and publishers into,
and me,
tizzy,
and the people
and
who interview you.
Right.
What are we talking about?
Well,
and the people who are listening,
deciding
whether or not they want to read this book.
Well, look, the thing about this book is you can open it up at any chapter and read that chapter, and it's going to be a satisfying experience. The chapters each work as their own
short story. Each chapter, different from an ordinary novel,
yeah.
You could pick, maybe not the best way to do it, but you could pick up a story in the middle of the book, read it, and say it would have a beginning and an end, and you wouldn't have to read the rest.
That's right.
You have an experience there.
There's an author, Dennis Johnson, who's best known. He won the National Book Award last year for Tree of Smoke, but he wrote a smaller book called Jesus' Son. I heard him speaking about that book, and it's similar in structure. It's a collection of linked stories, and he said, it's even smaller than my book, which isn't a very big book. But Dennis Johnson said, you know, I love this book. It's like a CD. You can just start it on any track and, you know, you open it up and
you could even have
experience.
It going. Well, I was going to ask you the question because I felt like I could have read it in any order and still it would make sense. But
it would make sense.
Put it in some order because that would be the better. That you would say, if you want to read these, read it. It's got a narrative. Look, we're talking about concept. Let's talk about some specifics.
Sure.
I'll tell you my favorite. Well, my favorite story right now because I identify with this character. But this is a story called The Gypsy.
Yeah.
And knowing that you're talking to an older guy who might fall down the stairs, will you tell us? Will you tell us this story?
Sure.
Or tell us as much of the story as you want to, and what you were trying to.
Yeah.
Then, when you finish, tell us what you're trying to do with it.
The gypsy is a story.
This is not main. The main character is not a gypsy.
No.
The main character is, imagine DG, an old guy.
The main character is a man named Cotton, who is a older guy who in his youth was a the chief of a pit crew of a NASCAR racing team.
I have to interrupt you. I mean, this is just straight up. But my son-in-law's named Cotton.
No.
So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, very few people are named Cotton. But
yeah, for sure.
Whammo, this was not the reason. I mean, the character, your Cotton, is not like my son-in-law.
Well, I love that name. Young,
but it's like me. Old.
Well.
Old and favorite grandchild.
Yes.
So, tell us that story.
Well, Cotton has a grandchild that he takes care of. His his daughter is in a nursing home with some physical and mental ailments, and he takes care of his grandson, and they have a very special relationship. But the genesis of this story came from when I was growing up in Greensboro. Anytime anybody had their house broken into in our neighborhood, you know, that my parents' friends would always say, "Oh, it's the gypsies," you know, and I mean, For the life of me, I never, ever believed that the gypsies...
Never saw a gypsy, but they're always there.
This was the name for anybody who, you know, burgled a house. And I just thought that this myth of the gypsy was fascinating and sort of hilarious. But I wanted to create a story where the gypsy is real and shows up at this house. Now... What happens is Cotton is an older man, and is caught in the storm. His basement is flooding. He goes down to check on the basement to make sure that flooding hasn't gotten out of control and ends
up. I'm sorry to want to tell this story. This is just terrible, but I was so identified with it. But Cotton's going down in the basement, and he's like many people who, as they get along in age, they start thinking about their family, about their history, about all of their papers, and they get fanatical.
He's become obsessed with genealogy.
Yeah, so the flood is going to destroy all of this. I'm thinking this could be me.
Well, all of his genealogy research is in the basement, and he knows the water's rising, so he goes down there to save it and ends up slipping in the water and falling and breaking his hip and is stuck in the water.
Another fearful thing that happens to
people. Sure.
So he can't move.
He's stuck halfway water. The water's rising in the basement. His genealogy research is ostensibly floating around him. And while he's stuck, somebody comes into the house, and it's the gypsy. And he...
So he's sitting there again.
Please.
Excuse me for stealing your story.
I like hearing it.
But he's sitting there. He's saying one thing. Oh my God! There's a strange guy who could rescue me and keep me from being drowned.
For sure.
The other thing, what's he doing in my house? Is he stealing everything?
Exactly.
So what was really going on?
Well, you know, I mean, and he ends up calling out for help, and the gypsy actually does pull him out of the water, but just far enough that he's not going to drown, and goes back to doing what he's doing upstairs with taking his stuff. Now, in the meantime, his grandson had been out of the house playing with his friend and comes home while the gypsy's upstairs, and of course Cotton's in the basement and can hear all this. The electricity's off, so the house is silent. He can hear the different footsteps, and the story sort of follows what happens when the grandson ends up being the one.
No, tell us this story. This is just one twelfth of the book.
That's right. The grandson ends up attacking the gypsy and sort of spooking the gypsy more than anything and getting him to, you know, flee after a while. The grandson is sort of a hero in the story, but Cotton still needs to take advantage of the moment to teach him a lesson about the smart way to interact with intruders. But
this is a nice point. I never knew whether or not I went along, but Cotton says, even though you kind of saved the situation by beating up the gypsy, you shouldn't confront. You should just give people, if people want to take something, let them have it. Is that so?
More so, Cotton is just obsessed with his grandson because he feels like his relationship with his daughter was stolen because of some medical circumstances. And, you know, I mean, in that point in the story, for me, it's him saying, like, no matter what, I want your safety to come first. And Cotton has to face his mortality several times in this story. One of those points is seeing his grandson become the one who's saving him in a way. His grandson is young. I can't remember the age exactly.
Not really old enough to be beating up gypsies.
No, not at all. And he has to see his grandson save the day. He has to see his neighbors who are younger than him interact with his grandson. And he realizes they have a very close relationship that he didn't know anything about. And so, you know, this story is about him facing mortality.
We're visiting with Nick Brown about his new novel or linked short stories under the title Flood Markers, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Nick Brown, one of our neighbors here in Chapel Hill and Carrboro, who is the communications officer for the Acklen Art Museum.
That's right.
In the daytime, and at night he's writing and taking care of a 10-month-old and still playing the drums a little bit on the side. This is an extraordinary collection of short stories and themed around one day in the life of a small North Carolina town the day Hugo hit.
That's right.
Hurricane Hugo hit. We talked about one of my favorite stories. The title, the name of the story. Tell us about where the name of the book came from.
Well, in Greensboro, there's a small creek near where I grew up called Buffalo Creek, the name of which I use in the book. But
there are Buffalo Creeks all over the state,
sure,
but the state,
yes.
So we can't pin you down.
No, but there's a small bridge over Buffalo Creek in Greensboro that would flood at the slightest thunderstorm. I don't understand what the municipal water system had going on in this little park with this bridge, but the park would flood. And in my memory, there were markers painted on the supports of the bridge with some years marked by them, marking the flood crests of
the
years
flood mark,
past.
The flood markers.
Now, I drove by the bridge about 2 months ago, and there are no flood markers
on
it. So I'm sure that they were there when I was a kid. I think they've been washed off.
But you see these from place to place. Somebody's
that's right.
Taken a piece of paint or something and marked something on then you say this is where the water was probably.
That's right. And so in my book, Flood Markers, this is the day that when Hugo comes through the park. In my book, the water rises so much that the water rises all the way over the bridge. And in the book, this is the one flood that went so high, there's not even a mark they can put on. But also for me, I like the metaphor of these stories are the flood markers. So the title worked for me.
Well, this is a more complicated story about characters who've been in other stories story that gives the story that's called Flood Markers, too. A little bit more complicated maybe to tell than the story about Cotton, but would you give it a crack and or you give it a try? Or you can just tell us what it's about if you want to tell the whole story.
Yeah, well, the story Flood Markers that the book has the title from is about two neighbors, best friends, who live on a small park like I just described, whose parents have unbelievably gone out of town during the storm. They've gone to the...
And left these young teenagers to fend for themselves.
They're teenagers.
Bad choice.
Very bad choice. But these neighbors, these two families are very close. They co-own a condo or something down at the beach. And the parents go down there to board that up for the storm. Meanwhile, these teenagers are left. Now, they're two girls, Fletcher and Greer. And Fletcher is suffering from...
I just have to interrupt you again because, I mean, Greer is an unusual name.
Yeah.
It's my name and my son's father's name, so...
Is it?
How did you know? But it's a boy... For us, it's a boy's name.
Yeah.
In your story,
Greer
is the name of the... maybe the central character of this...
Yeah.
Or a important character in the story, a young woman.
It was the name of a friend of mine growing up, and I like the sound of it. Same
it's
with Fletcher. It is a great name.
And Fletcher's a great name.
You know, I
can't have no claim to that one.
Well, you know, it's funny. None of these names are extremely unusual to me. I just like the sound of them. I did an interview recently where with another author who asked me about my outrageous names, and I thought...
Oh, tell him they're very good names.
He named Cotton, and he named Greer, and he named Fletcher, so God forbid he meet your family. But in any case, Greer and Fletcher are our best friends and neighbors. Fletcher's ill, and her older brother, Mike, is taking care of her while the parents are at the beach. And in the meantime, Mike and the neighbor, Greer, have developed a romantic relationship that they're trying to keep from Fletcher, the sick sister. So in this story and in another story in the book, the secrets are revealed and the neighbors and the siblings have to sort of come to terms with the secrets. Yeah.
Well, maybe that's all that... I mean, it is a story... It would be hard to explain. I guess it's a story to be read and to be thought about.
My favorite part of that story is when Greer dives into the
tell us about this event. Now, this by itself is a great moment.
It is.
And what I thought, this is where this sick girl who's just revived her best friend, her in a complicated relationship... It's very imaginative, and this girl who you think might be on death's door in some respects is very ill. She just jumps in this flood water and swims away.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a couldn't be for real. You just have to
That's what's beautiful about being a fiction writer. But it, you know, whether it's real or not, it's her chance to live again for a moment, you know, despite how sick she is. So she dives into the water, and
you think in other fiction writers have done this, is that this is the myth of the most affirming way to die.
Yeah,
is to swim out into
the awakening, Kate and Chopin. Yeah, right.
And I mean, is this all going on in your mind, or are you just making this up as you go along? What's going on?
You know, mostly the latter. But you know, with any writer, it's what I write's informed by what I read. And I did think about The Awakening by Kate Chopin, where her protagonist ends up killing herself basically by swimming out into the water, but. And this is an affirming moment for me, because
she's saying, I'm really alive.
Exactly. And she's not swimming out there to die. She's swimming out there to live. So it's one of my favorite moments.
We're visiting with Chapel Hill's Nick Brown about his first published work, just out, Flood Markers. And he and I will be right back after the short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. I'm visiting with Nick Brown. Nick is the author of Flood Markers, a brand new book, and we've been visiting about the book. Nick, I'm more curious maybe than anybody else about how writers get to be writers and how they get to be successful writers. And you told us earlier that you, after a 5-year break, to go play in a band, and what goodness knows what you learned during that time, but and what you might write about later upon reflection. But went to Columbia, and a lot of people learn to write at Columbia. Apparently, a great place. That's what you went to do. But did it work? Living in New York, and
it. It did to a certain extent. I had wonderful writers as teachers there. And, I mean, the most important part about that was just being in I took these writing workshops in college. It's just nice having deadlines and having a room full of people to read your work, really. I mean, at that point, that's the most helpful thing.
The best way the best teaching is hearing what people say about whether or not you agree with them is...
For sure.
Throwing it out there and having... supposedly honest people tell you what they think.
We had really amazing teachers. I mean, Columbia is in New York, and so they have a wealth of authors who then get to just take the subway up and teach these classes. So I was definitely spoiled. But again, you know, what I was trying to get at earlier is even then I didn't really know if what I was doing was working. And insofar as I didn't know if my writing was really working. And so I graduated from college and went back on tour with some other groups.
As a journeyman drums player, is that what you?
Yeah, there was. I found there was surprisingly
side man.
Yeah,
is that
side
what
man. I mean, I like the sound of that. Yeah. There's surprisingly few working drummers in my genre in New York, so I was getting a lot of work, which is great. But I sent this manuscript off to the Iowa Writers' Workshop on sort of a fluke, and they called me up and said, you're in. They gave me this wonderful
fellowship.
Tell us fellowship.
About a lot of the writing community knows that if you've been to the Iowa Writers Workshop, you're special. I don't know what it's like.
Yeah.
But tell us about what it is and why it's so special.
Well, it's the oldest creative writing graduate program in the country. And the first, they're the ones who came up with the idea of this workshop setting of writers getting together to work. In many ways, it's basically it's a writer's retreat, a sort of, I think of it as a writer's summer camp. 2 years, they get 25 writers who, you go live in Iowa for 2 years, and they get the best of the best and for teachers to just spend time with you and your writing. I mean, it's an unbelievable opportunity to write and to, you know, get feedback from other amazing writers who are your teachers. For me, I learned as much, if not more, from the other students.
So you're critiquing each other's work in addition to having your work critiqued by well-known teachers and writers.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's...
And is it for fiction writers only?
It's for fiction writers and poets. For me, when I got in, I thought, oh my God, this is great. I can go and write for 2 years. The fact that I was going to learn a lot about my writing was embarrassingly not at the top of my list. I learned so much, really, I mean, from the teachers and the students. But by the end of it, I don't ever want to go and do another writing workshop again.
It was a good thing to have done.
Yes.
Well, tell us, I know you've got 2 years of learning experiences, and a lot of it is non-transferable, but surely there's some things that you give us one or two things that you learned that would be relevant to what some of the rest of us who try to write every now and then.
Well, you know, the most important thing that I learned is that words and language are an extremely reactive tool. And what I mean by that is, so many of us, when we write, we just think that we're sort of floating these ideas and that we don't have to be crystal clear on what we're writing. We just write something and, oh, the reader gets it, you know? And unless you give the reader what they need to get it, they're not going to get what you need.
As a reader, boy, I appreciate that advice, because I find myself so often, I mean, maybe I'm dense, but I just haven't gotten what the writer I know thinks is obvious.
And a lot of times the writer doesn't know either, you know? So first and foremost, I learned clarity of language and the importance of language and word-by-word language sentences, you know? So there was a real premium
craftsmanship part of this art.
Yeah, which was really helpful for me. And the second thing I learned, this is not a writer's workshop stamp, but I just didn't want to be boring, you know? I wanted my stories to just be these little explosive devices, you know? And I spend a lot of time compressing and condensing and trying to cut out anything that was going to lose a reader. And so for me, it was just a lot of time seeing how these bits and pieces would react with other readers, you know, that I'd get to be closed in a room
More important today even than ever, in the sense
that
you only have your reader for a moment and they're gone. If you don't, I don't want to say tease them is not the right word, but something like that, to constantly be aware, I've got to keep my reader's interest on, not just on every page, just almost on every sentence.
Well, it is a sentence by sentence endeavor, you know. It's not about the story. I mean, it is about the story in a way, but unless the language is powerful and popping off the page, your reader is going to start losing interest.
Tell us about what the Our Writers Workshop brand did for you.
Well, I heard a metaphor in Iowa that
You can say it.
The metaphor was that being, you know, a writer at Iowa is like being, you know, recruited to play on the Duke basketball team was the metaphor. I explained to the person that what they meant was the Chapel Hill basketball team. Well, they were from Iowa, so they didn't understand. But, you know, what it means is it does give you a stamp of approval, and it also, luckily...
If you're a pro scout...
Yeah.
And Mike Krzyzewski has recruited you.
Yeah.
Or if Roy's recruited you.
Right.
It's different from if you happen to be a great basketball player playing in for a different school where you just happen to be.
That's true.
So this Our Workshop stamp gives you an advantage over other writers.
It did. I mean, I'm a firm believer that good writing rises to the top, and it's the writing that matters. I'm lucky, though, that at Iowa, we did all of our workshops in an old Victorian house, and agents would fly in from New York and sit in the lobby and pick up our photocopied stories and read them and hunt us down. That's how I got my first agent. She was waiting for me outside the classroom door.
A totally different story from anything that we hear from our colleagues or writers begging for an agent.
I'm so spoiled. So that was a wonderful, wonderful help for me. But more so, it was it helped my confidence as a young writer to have the Iowa say.
Blood Markers is just out. But it is out now, and you can
it's out.
Filtering its way into the bookstore, so you can get it. It's worth if you don't want to buy it, go to the bookstore and just read one of those stories and see if you can then not buy it. anything else coming down the line?
Well, there are going to be some readings locally. I'll be at the Regulator in Durham.
I guess what I'm talking about, you're going to write another book?
Well, like I mentioned, this novel that I just turned in about the doubles tennis players, and then, I just turned that in a few weeks ago. I'm going to be editing that for a while, I think. And then after that, I don't know what's next.
Well, we're thrilled that you take time to come and visit with us about flood markers and about your other work. And Nick Brown, we'll look forward to reading a lot more from you in the future. Hope you'll come back soon.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Thanks all y'all for listening. I'll be back same time tomorrow.